All right, welcome to the Michael Slate Show. And I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we got a packed show, so I'm going to jump into it right away. I'm just going to tell you what's up, and then we're going to get into it, all right? At the back end of the show, we're going to be talking about a whole new ecosystem, a man-made ecosystem that has sprung up in the oceans, and we'll be talking with Dr. Drew Talley, a marine biologist from San Diego University, and we'll be talking about what is now being called the plastosphere, so you don't want to miss that, because just that name alone should be enough to pique your interest. In the middle section of the show, we're going to be listening to a new audio message that was posted on the revcom.us website at midnight, January 1st. And it's a message from Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party, with a New Year's message, a call to revolution. So you don't want to miss that. And starting the show off, I was, I came back from the East Coast about a week ago or so, a little bit more than a week ago. And I was going through places that I like to check out for news and stories that don't normally get a whole lot of attention, but that are very critically important stories. And one of those sites that I go to is consortiumnews.com. And Robert Perry, who's from consortiumnews.com, has been on the show a number of times, and it's always been a pleasure to talk with him. And he's always providing some eye-opening, he's opening up people's eyes. It's sort of like sticking an electric prod in your nose and your eyes pop open, okay? And what I found was a series of articles that Bob had done on the New York Times and the slam dunk evidence they had provided last summer proving that the Syrian government was guilty in the August 21st sarin attack near Damascus. And all the evidence that they showed and all that. And what Bob has been arguing and revealing is that, wow, pretty flimsy stuff that they got there, and it's a pretty dangerous situation that they have been able to just deal with that. So I want to welcome Bob Perry to the show today. Bob, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Michael.
Sure. Well, let's jump into this right away. As I was saying that in the introduction, the U.S. was threatening war, and people remember this last summer, and there was all kinds of questions out there about, and actually maybe not enough questions, but the idea that there was use of sarin, a chemical weapon in Syria, against civilians, against people, and the war drums were beating very hard. And the New York Times in particular, the paper of record, the one that everybody goes to for the truth, was presenting a certain story. What was the problem there with the story that they were presenting? What was it, and what was the problem there?
Well, the New York Times in September put out a front-page story, which was derived from a map showing supposedly the flight paths of two missiles that were implicated in these attacks in August, and tracing their flight paths back to an elite Syrian government military base. Northwest of Damascus, near the presidential palace. This supposedly showed, almost like a Perry Mason moment, pointing at the criminal, that there was really no question that these attacks came from the Syrian government, not from possibly some element of the Syrian rebels or some other source. And that was what was sort of sold to the American people. And since the Obama administration, even though they reached the same conclusion as the New York Times, had refused to present any evidence that could be independently evaluated, no tape recordings that they claimed to have, no intercepts, nothing that they were sort of alluding to, the only real evidence that was out there was this map showing that the flight paths going back 9.5 kilometers, one from Mu'ammadiyya, which is a suburb south of Damascus, and one from Samalka, which is a suburb east of Damascus. And that's what the Times presented, and that pretty much sealed the deal.
Well, there's a... But there was a big problem there, huh?
Right. There was a big problem there, and there was a number of problems. First, the rocket that landed in Mu'ammadiyya had no sarin. The UN inspectors went and found no sarin, no other chemical weapons there. That missile also had clipped a building on its descent, which would have made getting any kind of accurate calculation of the flight path impossible. But more importantly, it didn't have any sarin. So that was one of the two missiles that was used. The other rocket, the one in Samalka, did have sarin, and you perhaps could get some kind of a flight path from that. But the real crushing problem to the New York Times analysis was that the various rocket experts who examined this, what kind of rocket was used, concluded that these could only go about 2 to 3 kilometers. They could not go 9.5 kilometers. And this was basically, it became a consensus among rocket experts from MIT and elsewhere that this was just not a possible scenario, that you could not do this vectoring analysis as the New York Times did, because the rockets they got about one third of the way. So the New York Times had been very reluctant, as it often is, to admit such a major mistake. The mistake was obviously reminiscent of 2002, when the New York Times did their famous aluminum tube story about Iraq, saying that because Iraq was buying some aluminum tubes, those must be used for nuclear centrifuges, and therefore Iraq had a secret nuclear program, and therefore the U.S. had some justification to invade in 2003. Of course, that turned out to be false as well. So, but the New York Times doesn't like to, when it makes those kinds of big mistakes, it doesn't like to admit them.
Yeah, I remember somebody that worked for the New York Times once telling me that, well, truth is a relative matter. And actually, what it is if it's printed by the Times, it happened, whether it happened or not.
The Times is very good about correcting people's middle initials if they get that wrong. But when it comes to something like starting a war on false pretenses, they're a little less willing to make that kind of correction.
Yeah, well,
But the point was that with the story that I think you're referring to, I've done several stories sort of pointing out the problems with the Times analysis, including I found a comment from one of the UN inspectors who also was saying that the missiles could only go about 2 kilometers. And so the pressure was kind of building on the New York Times. And then several days ago, the New York Times ran a story. It was in my edition, it was on page 8. It was below the fold. It had some innocuous sort of title, like more information available on Syrian missiles or something. And if you read down to the 18th paragraph of this story, the New York Times had a graph that said our analysis doesn't make any sense if you accept this consensus emerging from rocket experts that these missiles could only go 2 or 3 kilometers. So they did kind of, if you really worked at it, you could find the New York Times admitting they got it wrong.
You know, in my edition of the Times, the headline said, oops, ooh, look over there, what's that? and I'm laughing about it in a certain sense because it's such a horrible thing in terms of particularly something that you just mentioned in terms of this was very much a key piece of beating the drums for war. And before we get into that, though, I want to remind listeners that you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking with Bob Perry from ConsortiaNews.com, and we're talking about the New York Times and deception around what actually happened when there was a buildup to war with Syria last summer, and what the New York Times was saying about it, and what was true and what wasn't true. You know, Bob, that's a big thing. Like when you talk about this, I know there was a couple things in your a couple pieces on your site that actually said straight out deception by the New York Times, and that, you know, to me, I wanted to ask you about that, like, because when you look at all the evidence that you've pointed to, and consistently pointed to, it wasn't like you weren't saying, wait a minute, there's a problem here. You know, you were actually pointing out what was going on. And as further things were uncovered, you kept pointing them out consistently and consistently and said, you know, and said it wasn't like there wasn't any opportunity to say, OK, well, we missed that. Instead, there was actually it continued to develop and develop, including, you know, well, let me ask you that. What, you know, there was an element of outright deception here, it seems.
Well, the problem was that the Obama administration, much like the Bush administration did a decade earlier, was making a case for war, in this case, a war in Syria, where Bush went to war in Iraq. And they were trying to blame, they were trying to set up a casus belli, which was this missile attack, the sarin attack on August 21st. And I don't know who did the attack. I'm not sure if it was the government or rebels or some other, maybe a terrible accident. But the point was that the Obama administration presented zero evidence that could be independently evaluated. They simply made assertions, and they covered up something. They covered up the fact that there were many analysts inside the U.S. intelligence community who had these doubts as well. The Obama administration released something called a government assessment, which no one had ever heard of before. Usually they're national intelligence estimates, which reflect the consensus of the 16 U.S. intelligence agencies. But if they had done that, they would have had a lot of footnotes saying, you know, this analyst disputes this and so forth. There would have been a much murkier picture. So what the Obama administration did was try to conceal this degree of dissent inside the U.S. intelligence community and sell this as a slam dunk case, much as Bush tried to do with Iraq. And then, of course, the fact that the major newspapers did not call out the administration for its lack of evidence allowed them to get away with it. And then on top of that, the New York Times, a few weeks into this controversy, comes out with this front page story about the intersecting missile flights pointing to this Syrian military base. So you had this the same kind of problem you had a decade ago on Iraq. You had it repeated on Syria. The only difference is that President Obama decided at the last minute not to go to war, whereas President Bush eagerly went to war. But it wasn't that the system did not provide any kind of checks and balances that you might hope it would, especially after seeing what happened 10 years ago. You might expect that the U.S. news media would be more skeptical this time. They weren't. And there would be more resistance internally to this kind of false intelligence, which there wasn't. It turned out that President Obama did make this decision not to go to war, which was obviously a big difference from Bush. But the way we got to that point had some very serious similarities to what happened a decade ago.
Mm-hmm. Now, let me ask you something, because it's not, you know, as I was saying earlier, it's not like there wasn't some kind of opposition being pointed out there in terms of the press, in terms of what you guys did. And then Seymour Hersh also did a piece that actually questioned and called into question the basic tenets that were being advanced, you know.
And, Cy Hersh, one of the most renowned investigative journalists in our lifetimes. He was not able to get his story published in the United States. I'm told it was the New Yorker, where he often publishes, wouldn't take it. He may have also, as I understand it, offered it to the Washington Post. They didn't take it. He ended up publishing in the London Review of Books. So here you have, and the main point of Hersh's piece, similar to the stuff we were doing, was to point out that there was much greater dissent inside the U.S. intelligence community than President Obama and his advisors had acknowledged. So, and that's a big deal, because if you can conceal the fact that there isn't this kind of consensus when you're trying to create a basis for war, it makes it hard for the American people to weigh in intelligently on what they would like to see done. It's more a way of manipulating the public rather than informing them. But here you have Cy Hersh publishing in the London Review of Books, and that says something very very difficult and painful about our media structure in the United States. For all the media we have, for the 24-hour cycles on the cable news shows, that they can't find a home for, no one can find a home for Cy Hersh's reporting. It's pretty serious a situation that's developed.
Yeah, and I want to get into that a little bit later towards the end of the interview, but there's a couple questions I wanted to ask too, because one of the things that, you know, when you think about this in terms of the, you know, what was marshaled and what wasn't, and what was put out there. One of the things that stood out to me, and you guys pointed this out, you pointed it out in your pieces on consortiumnews.com. One of the things that was pointed out, I think more recently, was it the thing about hexamine? And the fact that when they investigated the sites, they found a lot of hexamine, and the New York Times actually also marshaled that as evidence of this shows yet again. Sarin attack, this, and this. And there's actually a whole other story to hexamine. And the reason I bring that up is because it was astounding that, you know, when you find out what actually is the truth behind hexamine and where it could have come from, the things were much more open, but the Times was really bent on a whole mission, which I think is not unrelated to things like Remember the Maine or the Gulf of Tonkin or any of these other things that where the press has actually come out and played a major role. And the major role that it actually is designed to play in a lot of ways in terms of backing up, you know, what the system needs or feels is going for in the world.
Well, that's a good point. The hexamine story was another example where the New York Times slanted the evidence. They took the most incriminating possible interpretation of the appearance of hexamine, which, you know, can be involved with, it can be used as some additive to a sarin mix. To sort of maintain it from and give it more stability, but it also can be in heating oil and regular explosives and a whole bunch of other things. So if you bury that fact, that there's a lot of innocent explanations of why hexamine would show up in soil someplace, and you hype the darkest possible explanation, you're really slanting the news again. And that fits also with the story from 2002 on the aluminum tubes in Iraq. I suppose, yeah, aluminum tubes could be used for a nuclear centrifuge, but they were clearly much more likely meant for artillery purposes. And that's ultimately what turned out to be the truth. And if you read deep, deep, deep into that New York Times story, you'd see a paragraph saying the aluminum tubes could be used for artillery pieces. And you see something similar in the piece they did on hexamine. They have this very, you know, excited talk about how this is more evidence that the Syrian government is at fault. But then you find deep in the story a paragraph saying, you know, hexamine also is a byproduct of heating oil and other kinds of explosives. So, you know, you get this sort of this slanting of the evidence, which the Times has very, very tragically done in the past and is continuing to do in the present. It'd be one thing if the Times was presenting all the various pieces of possible evidence on all sides and just getting everything out there for the public to read. But it's not doing that. It's concealing information that would suggest that perhaps the Syrian government was not responsible, and it's hyping information that would suggest the Syrian government is responsible. And that's not the way journalism is supposed to work.
Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Bob Perry from ConsortiumNews.com, and we're talking about the New York Times and its deception and falsification of reality in order to beat the drums of war back last summer. And they continue, actually, even now in relation to Syria, and they continue in a certain sense. Because I got to tell you, Bob, when I read the oops article from the New York Times, it was kind of just that. It was like, you're waiting for them to say, mea culpa, whatever, you know, and it's like, oh God, we were so wrong, how could we have done this? There was nothing that came out that even indicated that, and it leads me to we'll see how much further we can go, but I want to talk about the journalistic standards, because, you know, you raised earlier in this discussion the point about journalistic standards in terms of how things should operate, how the approach that journalists should take and that the press should take, and the reality, compare that to the reality, contrast it with the reality of what we see in the New York Times and many other papers. And you yourself paid a price for this. And I was thinking about you, Gary Webb, the stuff that you said about Seymour Hersh, but all of these people who have gone out to fight to bring truth to light, and the journalistic standards operate against, you know, in terms of what actually runs the media, operates against people like yourself.
Right. You know, I worked for the Associated Press and Newsweek and PBS Frontline and other sort of mainstream news organizations for many years, and did some important stories. Many of the Iran-Contra stories were stories that I was part of developing for the Associated Press and later Newsweek. But even though those stories turned out to be right, there was a great deal of pressure placed on me and also on my editors and the news executives over me to silence what I was doing and to punish me for doing it. And that's a recurring theme you get. We saw it, you know, I did the first stories with my colleague Brian Barger for the AP on Contra drug trafficking back in late 1985. And those stories were attacked. The New York Times dismissed them as basically crazy and baseless. They turned out not to be, but the New York Times wasn't going to reverse itself once it sort of made the call. And then when poor Gary Webb for the San Jose Mercury News comes along in 1996 and revives the story and shows some of the domestic consequences inside the United States, i.e. the crack epidemic, he comes under heavy attack from the New York Times and the Washington Post and the LA Times, and is ultimately driven out of journalism. His even though the CIA actually does a fairly honest investigation of itself, and its inspector general comes out and says, yes, you know, this actually was a bigger problem than any of us sort of understood, more than I understood. The CIA knew much more about the Contra drug trafficking than we did, and had been hiding it and been sort of trying to discredit people who were exposing it and keeping information from federal investigators and from Congress. So that was the reality. But Gary Webb never was rehabilitated, never was given his career back. You know, ultimately, he commits suicide in 2004 after he runs out of money and is in a pretty desperate situation. So that's the kind of situation journalists really face. And when you have someone like Cy Hirsch, despite his, obviously, if you have a long career, there are things you probably have done that aren't perfect as a journalist, but he's done a lot of very important, high-quality journalism, and the fact that he's being sort of shunned from the U.S. press is another indication of what you're talking about, this failure of the U.S. press institution to give the American people the information that they need to operate within a democracy. Our role should be to inform the public so it can act, not to manipulate the facts to kind of guide the public in some predetermined direction. And too often we end up doing the second part.
And the danger of that is, unfortunately, repeated.
The danger of that is we end up in wars that shouldn't be fought. We end up with policies that are highly destructive. And we've certainly seen some of that. We saw that most demonstrably, I suppose, in with the Iraq War. But you can take that back to the Vietnam War, and you go through any number of similar incidents where the American people are inadequately informed or sometimes outright disinformed, and they end up not being able to exercise their role in a democracy by holding people accountable, throwing people out of office who deserve it, and so forth. It's a way, really, of controlling the public, not empowering the public.
Mm-hmm. All right, Bob, we're going to have to wrap it up, but thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you, Michael.
Sure. Talk to you again, man. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we've just been talking with journalist Robert Perry from ConsortiumNews.com about the New York Times and its falsification of the news in order to foment war in Syria. We're going to take a quick musical break and be right back. All right. Welcome back. And that is Dance of the Revolution from Conspiracy of Thought. Really like that song. That's actually, you know, that's got my blood flowing. I'm jumping up and down here. I'm watching people and I'm wondering why are my assistant producers and whatnot also banging on the desk? Because that's a hell of a song and it gets you really, gets everything going on you. And I wanted to use that to introduce this next segment. At 12:01, January 1st, there was a message, an audio message from Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party. It was a New Year's message, and it's a call to revolution. All right, and I want people to hear this. So we're going to, without saying any more, I just want you to hear this. Let's go into it now. Federico, let's play track 3.
This is Bob Avakian, chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party, with a New Year's message, a call to revolution. We need a new world. A radically different world. Look at the world today. Destruction of the environment. Youth in the inner cities robbed of a future. Presumed guilty for being black or brown. Hounded and shot down by police. Incarcerated in huge numbers. Women are raped, battered and murdered. Denied their basic humanity and their full potential as human beings. People scorned. Bullied, brutalized for being gay, or just being different. Millions of children dying every year from starvation and disease. Immigrants driven from their homelands, forced into the shadows, exploited, deported, ripped away from their children. Slaughter and enslavement in the name of one god or another. Wars, torture, and massive government spying. Things are this way because of the system that rules over us and declares its special right to rule the world. A system like this is a system that no one should put up with or go along with. It needs to be swept off the face of the earth, and it can be. This system is not a mystery or something that only a few people can understand, and it is not all-powerful. This system has a name, capitalism. This system is full of contradictions. An economy based on ruthless exploitation and dog-eat-dog competition, repeated crises, unemployment and poverty, savage inequalities, claims of peace and justice for all that are bitter lies, contradictions that this system cannot resolve. All this is the basis to bring this system down and bring something much better into being. A lot of people say, you can't really change things. Nobody cares what we think. Those who have the power don't give a damn about us. Yeah, they don't. But so what? Their power is illegitimate anyway. A law and order of injustice and exploitation enforced with brutality, murder, high-tech assassination, and devastation here and worldwide. It needs to be overthrown. And what we do matters a great deal. Our lives should be and can be about something with meaning and purpose that is really worth living for and fighting for. Why should we do what they want us to do? Killing and crippling each other, trying to beat down or beat out each other, ending up in jail or paralyzed or dead at an early age, instead of joining together to go up against the system that has got us in this mess in the first place. Why should we accept the lies that people who are of a different color or live in a different place or speak a different language or love in a different way are less than human and deserve to be locked up or beaten down or murdered? Why should girls and women be treated like things whose only value is to be used for sex and having babies? Why should we go along with the sickening culture of this system which says money is more important than people, and people are only a means to make money? Why should we believe that it's all in God's hands, when all this horror and suffering is completely unnecessary and could be ended? Why should we accept the way things are, or just try to make things a little bit better, still living within this system that will keep on destroying the lives of human beings and denying a decent future to the youth all over the world? We need to, and we can, do much better than this. We can change all this. We can change ourselves as we change the world, fighting the power and transforming the people for revolution. Revolution is not an impossible dream. It is not unrealistic. Changing all of society, changing the whole world, is not a crazy or dangerous idea. What is crazy and dangerous is going along with the way things are and where things are heading under this system. Revolution, a radical change in how society works, how we relate as human beings, what our values are, how we understand the world and act to affect it. This is what we, what people all over the world, desperately need. And it is a lot more realistic than trying to fix this system. People say, revolution has been tried and it didn't work. It got smashed or turned into something worse than what it was fighting against. Everybody has given up on revolution. No. The process of revolution has gone through twists and turns. Mistakes have been made. There have been setbacks and defeats. But the truth is that in its short history so far, the Communist Revolution has accomplished great things on a road of liberation never before taken. This revolution remains the only road which can actually bring about a radically different and much better world. As long as human beings continue to be exploited and abused, there will be the need and the possibility for this revolution. And everybody has not given up on revolution. On my part, I have not just refused to give up, but have recognized the need to make new breakthroughs for this revolution. I have gone to work to learn from the experience of revolution and from experience more broadly. And this has led to a new synthesis of communism, a deeper, even more scientific understanding of the methods, the goals, the strategy and plan for making revolution and creating a new society. On this basis, our party, the Revolutionary Communist Party, is right now building a movement for revolution, and we are building our party as the leadership that is needed for that revolution. But this movement and this party have to get much stronger. More and more people need to get with this. I call on youth in the inner cities, men and women in prison, people struggling just to keep from going under, mocked by the lie that you can make it if you try. All those catching hell under this system, everyone deeply troubled by the desperate situation and dismal future facing so many youth. I call on students, academics, musicians, and other artists, all those outraged by the crimes perpetrated by this system, everyone who agonizes over the state of the world and the future of humanity, to seriously get into this revolution. Go to the website revcom.us and read the newspaper Revolution, where our party puts forward why we need revolution, what the goals of this revolution are, and how to work for this revolution. With the guidelines this provides, thousands can move now in a unified way and build up the basis to lead millions when the time comes, fighting back against the injustices of this system and learning as we fight, spreading and deepening the movement for revolution, preparing minds and organizing forces for revolution. In the neighborhoods and schools, everywhere people are who need to know about and join in this revolution. Helping to bring about and getting ready for the time when millions can be led to go for revolution, all out, with a real chance to win. This is no joke. And it is not just some grand idea with no basis in the real world. It is real. And it is being taken up with a serious scientific method and approach, and with the joy of striving for a world where the suffering and madness that is now daily life for the masses of humanity will be gone, and whole new dimensions of freedom and of human potential will open up for people everywhere, no longer divided into rich and poor, masters and slaves, rulers and ruled. No longer fighting and slaughtering each other, but working together for the common good. No longer destroying, but acting as fit caretakers for the earth. This is communism, the goal of our revolution, a future for the youth, for all of humanity, that is truly worth dedicating our lives to. This is Bob Avakian with a message of revolution. The challenge is there. The leadership is there. What's needed is you.
All right, what's needed is you, all right? And you want to check that out. You want to download the audio of that for yourself. You want to get a copy of it. You want to get a PDF file of it so you can email it out, whatever. Go to revcom.us, all right? And you can do that. You can hear it again and again and again. You can download it, carry it with you everywhere, send it out to everybody you know. Get it all around, all right? That's at revcom.us. We're going to take a quick break and be right back with Dr. Drew Talley to talk about the plastosphere. We'll be right back. right. That was Fishhead from Slim and the Soulful Saints. And, you know, this is just the weird way my brain works. We're going to do this piece on the oceans and what's going on in the oceans and the horrifying things that are happening there. And I kept thinking Fishhead. That's all I could think of. So I thought I would use that to introduce this segment of the show. Now, we're going to be talking with as I said the other day, I was reading the newspaper, maybe about, whatever it was, a week ago or so, and I came across an article talking about a new ecosystem being formed, and they called it the plastosphere. And I kept thinking, now, what the hell is that? What are they talking about there? And as I read the article and looked into it more and more, my eyes got big, my jaw dropped, and I said, damn, we got to talk about this. So we went and we found Dr. Drew Talley, who's a marine biologist from the University of San Diego. And he's also, you know, I have a whole list of things that he has done. And here it is. He's an assistant professor of marine science and environmental studies at the University of San Diego. He's the science director of the Aquatic Adventures Bahia program. And he's a member of the science advisory panel of the Southern California Wetlands Recovery Project. And he's here to talk with us about what the hell is going on with plastic, the plastosphere, and the new ecosystem. Drew, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Michael. It's great to be here.
Sure. Well, let's jump into it, man. Exactly what is this plastosphere? Because I'm sure a lot of people are listening and thinking, what is he talking about now? What is this plastosphere?
Yeah, you know, the term plastosphere is actually a pretty recently coined phrase, and I think it's just to try and show how ubiquitous plastic is in the environment now. So, you know, we have what they teach us in school about the atmosphere and the hydrosphere. So I think plastosphere is a relatively new term that I've started to hear used to discuss the plastic that is surrounding us in the environment.
But what is that? But then in relation to this, there's actually an ecosystem, and this is what's new, right? There's actually an ecosystem that has developed in relation to this, or with that at the heart, with the plastic at the heart of it.
In a sense, yes, that's true. What research has been showing is that these pieces of plastic, you know, when we think about plastic debris in the ocean or in the environment, well, you know, what's pretty well known is people think of, I don't know, about when I was a kid, there were always pictures of, I don't know, a seagull with a six-pack ring around its neck or something like that to show us, you know, oh, don't throw your trash in the water. Well, what people have started to realize now, what scientists have noticed, is that these pieces of plastic debris that get in the ocean can get colonized by microbes, and these little microbes and bacteria can help to break down the plastic. And most of the plastic that's actually in the ocean that is starting to be an emerging concern is in the form of tiny, tiny little pellets, you know, plastic that's broken down to the point where it's the size of a piece of confetti or smaller.
And on those little pellets, is it true that there's concentrations of huge numbers of tiny, tiny bacteria or microbes?
Yes, it's certainly true, and that's one of the ways in which some of the chemicals that are inside these plastics are getting released out into the environment.
And I read somewhere where they said that these microbes were actually different than the ones that exist in the ocean water that doesn't have plastic.
Right. They're the same microbes, but they are some of the rarer microbes that you don't find that commonly will be abundant on these pieces of plastic.
Mm-hmm. And let me ask you this, because, it's real. I'm trying to pick this apart, because when I read about this in the beginning, I kept thinking, and this is, you know, how my head works, right? I kept seeing, like, tiny little megalopolises, you know, on the, you know, sort of like the flying cars and stuff going around driven by microbes. Yes, I had way too many cartoons when I was growing up, but that was what I saw. And I'm kind of wondering about this, because I kept seeing it referred to as a man-made ecosystem. And, I guess actually what they're referring to it being was sort of like it was caused by human behavior. And even people referring to it as a microbial reef. What's that?
So what they're talking about is a few different things that are being lumped into one term. But like, for instance, when you say a microbial reef, these particles are sort of allowing concentrations of microbes. And like I said earlier, sometimes species of microbes that are pretty unusual to be able to concentrate themselves and have, as a coral reef does, a place to live, and therefore, as these plastic particles concentrate, so too do those microbes. I think the other thing people are talking about with this is that these somewhat larger pieces of plastic can actually help transport organisms. So you get invasive species, species that are coming from other places that are moving across the ocean on pieces of plastic.
Well, let's talk about this. Well, let me remind people first before we get into this, because I know we're going to get deep into this. We're talking with Drew Talley, who's an assistant professor of marine science and environmental studies at the University of San Diego. And we're talking about plastic and microbes and what people are talking about in terms of the news lately. If there's been the creation or the development of a new ecosystem based on all this. And we're trying to pull this apart and see what's real, what isn't. And this is the big question I have for you, Drew. What are the possible effects of just what you've been talking about? What are the possible effects of all this?
Well, that is what I think is both so puzzling and so potentially quite threatening, and that's what we need to understand. So the real danger, I mean, as I say, people are aware of most, I think most of your listeners have heard people talk about the Great Pacific Garbage Patch, you know, a bunch of plastic floating in the North Pacific, or you know, you may have seen pictures of an albatross feeding its young, you know, pieces of plastic that it picks up out of the ocean, which are certainly striking images and they're terrible things. But I think what we're starting to learn more about is what we call sublethal effects. So these effects that these plastics can have that aren't leading to a massive die-off of fish, or at least not an obvious one, but leading to things like, as these plastics break down in coastal regions, there have been studies showing that, you know, fish will start to, with certain types of chemicals, they'll develop more tumors. They'll have more difficulty reproducing. We're finding all sorts of, you know, there was a fairly recent study where they found like 9% of the fish that they caught, and this is in the open ocean, had plastic particles in their gut. And that's not even counting, you know, we have no idea about the ones who consumed plastic and then it passed through their system. And so I think, you know, I think this is similar in some ways to learning to recognize the subtle effects of things like we now worry about, you know, people know to be concerned about BPA in baby bottles or in your drinking water bottle. And I think this is just a completely, it's a new world, and it's a new thing that we need to try and understand so that we can wrap our heads around the potential dangers here.
Mm-hmm. Now, one of the things that I also kept reading about was people, and it's related to what you're saying in terms of the breakdown of the plastic. And I was surprised because, as you said, as you were pointing out, people having heard of the garbage patches in the, you know, the trash pit or whatever it is in the ocean and different concentrations of that. And then reading articles on this and having people say, all these scientists saying, well, you know, it's not really like that. It's not a situation where you're actually having a go out there and you suddenly look and there's just like endless miles of garbage and trash. But there is a point where it's you know, it's looking at you're looking at the ocean, and they say it's like tiny little things that have been little like almost somebody said described it as like sort of sparkles, you know, in the ocean.
Yeah.
And that is seems to be, you know, and I wondered when I was looking at that, I was wondering about, okay, how are we dealing with this? What does this mean? Because, you know, it's one thing to have, you know, like the garbage dump in the ocean, you know, it's another thing to have this going all the way up and down and really far out. And you in particular specialize in food webs, right?
Yeah,
and,
I do.
And
yeah.
What is the impact? What's the synergy between what's going on with all this plastic and food webs? And where's that taking us?
Well, I think that is what is so fascinating about this is we really don't, I mean, we are right on the edge of this brand new field of trying to understand what's going on with these plastics. And with food webs, I guess one thing that as a marine ecologist I've learned is that you never know when you're, you know, pulling one thread on a food web. If you have one species of fish or one crab or a gooseneck barnacle that is being adversely affected by something, you never know when pulling on that thread will unravel an entire ecosystem or have a minimal effect. And so the more we can try and pin this down and understand potential effects, I think the better off we are. And I certainly don't want to be saying, oh, well, this is doom and gloom, but it is something we just don't know enough about to say very much about yet. And so it's a really fascinating emerging field of science.
Mm-hmm. And one thing, it's interesting, too, because there's a huge amount of plastic every year that gets thrown into the ocean. I read something about it. It was like 75 pounds or 70 pounds of plastic in the ocean for every human on the face of the earth each year, you know?
And I hadn't heard that number, but it would not surprise me.
Yeah. And here's the question, though. It's sort of like, even thinking about that, what's the life of plastic in the ocean? And, you know, does the salt water, for instance, wear it down? And that has to do with what I was talking about earlier, too, in terms of the significance of the presence of this pitted or etched out plastic.
Right. So the things that make plastic so useful, that it's inexpensive and that it's really durable, are also things that make it an issue in our ecosystems. You know, it's inexpensive, so it's in almost everything. People don't hesitate to just throw away a piece of plastic, and it's durable, so it lasts in some form or another in the ecosystem for at least decades. And I think what we're finding is that as both the sun and seawater and microbes are breaking these things down, they're breaking them down into smaller and smaller particles, and these particles in some ways are just as, if not more, dangerous than, you know, a large piece of plastic, in that they're easily ingested by, you know, somewhere fairly low in the food web, and then bigger and bigger predators are taking them in.
Mm-hmm. Well, tell me this, Drew, and let me remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and we're talking with Drew Talley, Assistant Professor of Marine Science and Environmental Studies at the University of San Diego, and we're talking about plastic in the ocean, the bacteria that they're finding, the microbes they're finding on that, and the impact of all this. What's it actually saying about the state of things today? You know, one of the things, Drew, I was very interested in this, too, because another sort of side article pointed out that this is not just – it's not one ocean that it's not just the Pacific. They found it in the Atlantic. They find it everywhere they go, and even in the Great Lakes, that this kind of thing is cropping up.
Yeah, and I think that is a common misperception, is that, oh, there's that great garbage patch in the North Pacific, and that's it. But one of the studies you mentioned earlier by Ed Carpenter, which was looking at the microbes, you know, this was way back in, I think, 72 or 73, that discovery was made in the North Atlantic, so, you know, a continent away from where we're sitting right now. So, and you're right, freshwater, Great Lakes, I think, you know, it is just a really ubiquitous substance. And I guess, I mean, one of the things I really wanted to make sure I got across was that, yes, it's an emerging field of study, but I would hate for you and for our listeners to leave the show feeling sort of helpless. You know, that the reality is that most of these plastics are coming from the land. The vast majority are not coming from ships out at sea, et cetera. And they start their journey by washing down watersheds and then landing in our coastal waters. I think often people who don't live right on the coast feel a little disconnected from these issues. And I think that point you brought up is great, that this plastic is everywhere, and the source of it is actually usually on land. So, you know, as scientists are working to try and understand possible effects of this, every one of us can make a difference, you know, by doing something as simple as picking up trash, not throwing away that plastic bag.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now, you know, one of the things that's very important, I think, and also considering what are the root causes and what would be the solution of all that, you know, which to me is one of the reasons why we have to really deeply understand what exactly is going on with this, you know, and one of the things I kept thinking about, too, in relation to this, you know, the ocean has been, and we've had a number of people on over the last couple of years on the show talking about the state of the ocean, and the various reports that have been written, and that one conference that was over in England a couple of years ago, where suddenly all the scientists who had been working individually on the ocean and finding out their own individual results came together and put all their data together and said, ho, we're in big trouble here. The ocean is in it's an emergency situation with the state of the ocean right now, from what most of these people are saying, what most of the scientists that I've interviewed and whatnot have been saying, and what it seems like people are saying in general. The ocean, the acidity, the warming, the fact that people are talking about the increasing presence of elements that marked the past mass extinctions. What do you see as a relationship between what's developing with plastic and the rest of this, including this, you know, this again, this point about the concentration of the bacteria on us and what's and the degradation of the plastic into the ocean water and all this stuff? What do you see as the relationship between what's going on overall with the ocean and the state of emergency in relation to the ocean and what's happening with this?
I would say it is just another piece of the puzzle. It is another function of human population growing, and we often aren't aware of the consequences of some of these actions for decades after they begin. You know, plastic has been in the ocean for a long time, and it's just now we're starting to recognize, hey, we better pay attention to this. So I would say, and my experience as an ecologist and an oceanographer tells me that very often you will have multiple insults to an ecosystem that, you know, where the sum is greater than the net effect is greater than the sum of the individual parts. So if you have issues like acidification, overfishing, global climate change, and then you throw on top of that something else like plastics, et cetera, you're just ending up with, you know, often a fairly dire situation.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah. I think, you know, the education is really the key here. You know, that's obviously at the University of San Diego, that's one of the things we focus on is graduate and undergraduate education and trying to learn more scientifically, doing research to learn more about these issues.
Mm-hmm. Now, one of the things that I think there was a biologist at the one marine biologist at the Scripps Institute of Oceanography said that we humans are changing the basic rhythms of life in the world's ocean. And I thought that was a pretty heavy statement for someone to make. And I wanted to ask your opinion of that and explain to people what it means.
Yeah, so that was, I believe that was Dr. Miriam Goldstein. She was a graduate student at Scripps and is currently a Sea Grant Nous Fellow, I believe. And she was saying it was changing the rhythms of the ocean. To be honest, I'm not 100% sure what context she meant that in, but certainly what it means is, you know, one way you can take it is that we have a sort of normal cycle of degradation and growth in the ocean, but now we're throwing in these, if not permanent, at least semi-permanent substrates into the ocean that are growing microbes, they're transporting organisms, and so in that sense, we're really changing the sort of broad-scale rhythm of what's going on out there.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, one thing that sort of puzzled me too, and this is kind of, I don't know, it's kind of coming off of that, but there's actually there's a whole thing. I keep looking at this and thinking about, okay, the oceans, you know, it's true. We have had historically, it's been, you know, people would go out and they'd go fishing in a rowboat in the Jersey Shore back east, and you know, they think nothing of throwing, not only throwing the cans, throwing the plastic, whatever, you do whatever you would. The ocean became sort of like, if you put it in there, it's okay because nobody will ever see it, and you're not littering, you know. And but there's this whole thing that comes up that seems to be really changing and sort of people having a hard time getting their arms around it and getting their heads around it to actually be able to figure out what is the threat. And for some of these, I can't remember the name of the organization that is in England that does that state of the ocean study all the time. And they were saying that actually there's a problem that when you're looking at this, you could be talking about, you know, irreversible harm done to the ocean from many different levels, not just the plastic, but from many different levels within 35 years. And what the impact that has that plays out in terms of, you know, if the oceans die, we're all in a hell of a lot of trouble.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's absolutely true. I mean, I think historically, people used to feel that the ocean was an inexhaustible resource. The whole concept of overfishing seemed ludicrous, I think, to people. And I think part of it is just because as humans, we look at the ocean and all we see is the surface and it expands, you know, it's going off to the horizon. And I think quite clearly we've started to learn that it is not an inexhaustible resource. And it is not as though it is so large that we as humans can't affect it. And we're having very dramatic impacts on the ocean. So, yeah, I think you're absolutely right about that.
Mm-hmm. All right, Drew, we're going to have to wrap it up. We're running out of time, but thanks a lot for joining us today.
Okay, thank you very much, Michael. It was great being here.
Take care, man. All right, you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we've just been talking with Dr. Drew M. Talley, an assistant professor of marine science and environmental studies at the University of San Diego. And we've been talking about plastic in the ocean and what the hell is going on with that and a whole new ecosystem that's developing. As we go out, I want to step back a little bit and take some time to just think about what we've been hearing today, all right? And it's especially that we've been talking about the oceans, the destruction of the planet. We were talking earlier about the deception and the role of the press, the media in this system, and how it shapes and convinces people to do what the system wants them to do. Well, let's step back and talk about this a little bit, all right? So I want to read this piece from Bob Avakian that is really pertinent to what we've been talking about and really gets into why we have to pay attention to really striving to know the world, to understand the world in order to change the world, all right? There is a glaring lack of understanding and a crying need for people to understand that there is a system whose basic contradictions and dynamics set the terms of things in a fundamental sense, and for people to be given, in a living and compelling way, a materialist analysis and a materialist estimate, as Lenin put it, of how this system actually works and the role of different classes and social forces in relation to all this. We got to know the truth in order to change the world, and the truth in and of itself won't set you free, but we're not going to get free without the truth. That also comes from Avakian, and it all comes from his book, Basics. All right, I'm Michael Slate, the host and producer of the show, and I want to thank my guests for today, Robert Perry from ConsortiumNews.com and Dr. Drew Talley from the University of San Diego. And I want to thank my assistant producer, Henry Carson, and my production assistant, Jeff Pryor, my engineer for today, Federico Garcia, and each and every one of you for tuning in. If you want to write to me, you can at MichaelSlate@RedFuture.com. Again, that's MichaelSlate@RedFuture.com. If you want to follow me, you can do that on Facebook and Twitter. And really, really, the most important thing I want to leave you with today is go to revcom.us. Check it out, but especially check out the New Year's message from Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party, a call to revolution. We're going to go out now with a song that I've always liked just because it's so damn pretty. But you know what? It's pretty and it really, really has a lot of heart, a lot of imagination, and a lot of truth about what we need, all right? So this is Something in the Air from Thunderclap Newman. Talk to you again next week.